Gosh, I'm feeling a bit dazed and bewildered. I got very lost trying to get here, and I've been driving across farm fields for about 20 minutes, and then I sat in the open side buggy, which is probably better than how you've all been walking, but the rain just swept through the open side buggy. But anyway, it's lovely to be here. I've heard lots about Greenbelt over the years. I've never been before, so this is very exciting for me. But I'm here to talk about Judas. So here's the book. There he is. In a side profile, you always see Judas in side profile in medieval paintings because it was considered dangerous to look Judas in the eye, in both eyes, really, because he might seduce you to be like him in a sort of devilish way. So anyway, there's the cover. I'm feeling a bit unprepared. I thought I wasn't going to get here in time. Right, okay. Judas, I suppose the first question really to... should I stand behind the lectern? That's probably easier, isn't it? The first question is why write about Judas? And two reasons, really. I was brought up, and indeed still am, a Catholic. So we were very good in the Catholic Church at going to Mass every Sunday. Not so good at listening, but I was a very good child, so I would listen. And I always think when the Gospels are being read, it's much nicer to listen than to actually sort of follow them in the text in front of you, because you hear all these details as they're going by. So every Palm Sunday and in the build-up to Easter, you would listen to the Gospel being read. And this figure Judas kept coming up. As I was listening to it all, and the role of Judas in all of that, can everyone hear? That's good. Okay. And so the figure of Judas would come up, and I mean, clearly I didn't do this when I was five or six, but let's say, without giving away how old I am, because I'm conscious of those things, let's say for the last 40 years, yeah, I've got away with that. That's good. So for the last. For the last 40 years, I've just been on holiday, so I should look younger. So for the last 40 years, so listening to the gospel narratives. And I don't know about you, but when I listen to the gospel narratives, as the story goes through, there are bits that strike me as sort of psychologically plausible. There are bits that kind of make sense. Not psychologically plausible, that's a very silly word. But that make sense when you're listening, and bits that don't make sense. And one of the bits that never really made sense for me was Judas. And the bit that didn't make sense to me as I was listening is why he did it. What exactly was his motivation? What was going on in Judas's head at that time? If you think about it in very simple terms, here is the man who has been admitted to Jesus's inner circle, to the 12 people who are closest to him. I mean, it's hard enough to follow Jesus's example when we've never been in his presence, but certainly never been in his inner circle. Here is the man who is in Jesus's inner circle, and yet he still betrays him. What is that? Why did he do that? What exactly was his motivation? So that was one of the things that I wanted to try and work out sort of in my own mind, really. And I suppose the thing that goes with it, goes hand in hand with it, and the much more immediate reason for writing the book, was the kind of sense that Judas was still a very... was a word, a name, a character, a personality, whatever you want to say, that still resonated. I mean, obviously not here at Greenbelt, but in general, we live in a fairly secular, sceptical society. And I don't know if you noticed that, but most Easter times, newspapers, and I shouldn't be rude about newspapers because I work for them as well, but newspapers will always commission an opinion poll somewhere where they will ask 1,000 13-year-olds about the very basic details of the Easter story, and they'll always get it terribly confused. So they'll think that Jesus was made of chocolate, that when the stone was rolled away from the tomb, chickens jumped out carrying Easter eggs or whatever. They get the very, very basic details that those of us who've had a religious education would know very well, sign of the secular times. But the detail they always get right is they always know who Judas is. So here is this figure, Judas Iscariot, in a secular society, in secular times, people know straight away that Judas is the betrayer. They will know what he did. And indeed, I'd take it further, that the word Jesus, the word Judas, at a time when language and things where people bandy around insults so much and bandy around sort of cruel language that we scarcely take any notice of it anymore. People understand that Judas is an insult. People understand that it hurts. I mean, I had a pretty good example of this myself. When the book first came out, my very nice publishers arranged for me to go on a programme on a Sunday morning called The Big Question. I don't know if anyone's ever watched it. I hadn't, but I did, obviously, for that episode. So I went along to do this thing called The Big Question, which basically is people shouting at each other, as far as I could see. And so I arrived at the venue. They did it in a school in London. And I arrived and went up to the reception and said, "Hello, I'm Peter Stanford. I've come to talk about Judas and those things." And the young lady at reception picked up her microphone and said, "I've got Judas in reception." And it didn't feel very nice, I have to say. It didn't feel... Actually, it's better than my worst ever example of that was about 10 years ago, I wrote a book about the devil, a biography of the devil. And... yeah, you've got the joke coming up already, but I'm going to tell it anyway. So 10 years ago, so the BBC do this nice thing where you go on a whole range of local radio stations, but sitting in a studio in London, and they keep patching you through, whatever the word, technical word, those of you who are technical know, they keep putting you through to these other ones. And I promise you, about 5 of the 10 people, when they came on, they said, "I'm going to do Northern, I come from the North, so I'm not being rude about Northern people by doing a Northern accent now." They'd sort of say, "And on the line now, I've got Peter Stanford, who's just written an autobiography of the devil." It was radio. They couldn't even see me to know this about me. So, I've been called the devil. You may think I'm the devil at the end, who knows? Anyway, so Judas has the power to... The name Judas has the power still to kind of wound and to inflame people. And one of the first ideas I had as a subtitle from the book was taken from another rather good example I'd come across. I'm sure most of you are too young to remember this, and indeed certainly I am, just to clear up the age thing. But in 1965, Bob Dylan gave a concert at the... Free Trade Hall in Manchester, and it was just when he'd stopped playing his acoustic guitar and started playing his electric guitar. And Hartley said, "Lots of nodding going on here. These people are probably there, actually. I'm going to ask you a question in a minute." And halfway through, he was halfway through playing his music. There was a pause in the music, and someone in the audience just stood up and shouted "Judas" really loudly at him. Judas for changing, because the betrayal can often be seen as betrayal, for changing from acoustic to whatever. And Bob Dylan was furious at the time. There was a whole fuss about it all, and a long search to work out who did it, and they never found out who did it. So that lady over there, you didn't shout out. No, it wasn't you. Good to know. We could have solved a long mystery by knowing that. And so he was furious at the time, lots of writing about it. But what really fascinated me was a couple of years ago, Bob Dylan was interviewed by Rolling Stone magazine. He was on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine about, his extraordinary achievements over 50, 60 years or whatever, and, how popular and successful he was. And virtually the whole interview was given over to him moaning about this thing at the Free Trade Hall, where this lady didn't call him Judas, but that someone should call him Judas. And he used this phrase, he said, "Can you imagine all I'd done was change guitars, and these people called me the most hated name in human history." So Judas, the most hated name in human history, that power that it has. Another of the things that that intrigued me and got me wanting to write this book. I have to say, my publisher is sitting here, and we did a long way through the process decide that we were going to call the subtitle of the book was going to be "The Most Hated Name in Human History." But then there were two disadvantages to this. One view was that it was a bit negative. Mind you, with Judas, it's hard not to be negative about Judas in some ways. But also, my wife is a lawyer and has one of those very forensic lawyer's minds. And so when I told her this was going to be the subtitle of the book, she spent a long time lying awake at night worrying as to who might be more hated than Judas in human history. So each morning she'd come up with a new list. So Hitler was on there. Tony Blair at one stage was on there. Which, poor Tony. Sorry, Tony, if you're here. So... Judas. So the combination of that there's a mystery of his character in the gospel, of how he's presented in the gospel, and the fact that this name still has such extraordinary resonance for us. So that was the starting point for the book. And really what I tried to do in the book was, first of all, to work out, when we call people Judases, and I hesitate to say I don't do it, but when we call people Judases, whether we're using the name correctly, do we understand what he did as clearly as we can. Secondly, to look at how it's been used over the last 2,000 years, the people who have been scapegoated as Judas. So scapegoating is very much a theme of the book. Sorry. Better to cough with the microphone away from your mouth rather than cough into it. And thirdly, there was a phrase that I came across in the 5th century, Pope Leo the Great described Judas as the wickedest man who ever lived. So was Judas the wickedest man who ever lived, or have we slightly got him wrong in terms of understanding that? So that was really where I started. So let's start with, are we using it correctly? Let's start with the Gospels. There are no external sources for Judas apart from the Gospels. And so we could now spend the next, well, we could spend all this rainy afternoon talking about exactly what the Gospels are and how one should interpret the Gospels. I mean, at one extreme, you have people like Richard Dawkins, who I'm sure isn't in the audience. But if you are, Richard, it's lovely to have you here. You've finally seen sense. But we could start at the Richard Dawkins extreme, where he'll sort of say, oh, they were just all made up. It's kind of marketing. They're propaganda. It's kind of nonsense. Take notice of it. And we could go to the absolute other extreme, which says that every word written in all four Gospels is literally true, which obviously can't be literally true because... As I go through the character of Judas in the Gospels say very different, contradictory things about him. It seems to me, and I hope that I'm in an audience who might be amenable to this, that the important thing to do with the Gospels is to take them seriously historically as kind of records. If we start dismissing Judas and saying, oh, there's no external... no other source that tells us that Judas exists, then we're on a very, very slippery slope about it, writing everybody else off. I mean, historians make great play of the fact that there are two other sources for Jesus. There's Josephus's writings and there's Pliny's writings, but they come much later. They're certainly not contemporary sources. So let's take the Gospels kind of seriously and try and understand what they're trying to tell us as we go along. There are many trains around today, actually. It would have been a bit drier getting it. There are 22 references to Judas in the Gospels, just 22, which is extraordinary if you think about someone who's mentioned only 22 times in books written 2,000 years ago. That name still has the power to kind of wound people. All four Gospels include, the first reference for all of them is where they list the apostles. Interestingly, in Luke, there are two Judases when he lists the apostles. There's Judas, brother of James, and then Judas Iscariot. But all four of them mention Judas as one of the 12. And all four of them, interestingly, put him at the end of the list. So you go through everybody else who are son of, brother of, actually no sisters of, but son of, brothers of, and whatever, as you go through the list. And all of them put at the end Judas. And not only do they put Judas Iscariot at the end of the list, they also say who was going to go on and betray Jesus. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that is there. And it's interesting. I was thinking, you know, let's make an analogy with the Mousetrap here, Agatha Christie's play. I'm sorry, I'm going to spoil this for anybody, but Agatha Christie's play. It's a bit like going to see the Mousetrap, and the poster outside has a list of all the characters, and there's a big arrow over the head of the person who did it. I'm not going to tell you who it is in case you're planning a treat in the dry after today to go and see the master. But it's like kind of giving it away at the beginning in the Gospels. So why identify him? Because, you know, the normal narrative structure is to reveal things as the narrative goes along. But it's almost like right at the very beginning, we have to identify Judas as the betrayer. It's almost as if the gospel writers might have feared that we might have some sympathy for him. So they wanted to make sure we didn't have any sympathy at all at the very beginning by naming him as the betrayer. So all four of them do that. In terms of the details that we know very well about him, still picking through those 22 references, it's only in Matthew's gospel that he talks about the 30 pieces of silver. It's not mentioned anywhere else, the 30 pieces of silver. And obviously there is a link between the 30 pieces of silver as mentioned in Matthew's Gospel. There's an Old Testament reference, which in my rush this morning, it's slightly gone out of my mind, but it's in the book. There's an Old Testament reference there. And, you know, one of the things that the Gospels are doing, all the Gospels are doing, is referring back to the prophecies of the Old Testament, that Jesus was the fulfillment of the prophecies of the Old Testament. So the actual figure of 30 pieces of silver, one should treat with some caution. You get a lot of biblical historians who spent a long time working out the exchange rate between 30 pieces of silver and wages at the time, and it seems almost universally to come out as virtually nothing. So Judas was selling Jesus for very little. But the important point about the 30 pieces of silver in Matthew's Gospel, so let's is seen by let's take the Gospels in the order that, they were written, that we know that they were written. So most scholars now would agree that Mark's Gospel, although it comes second in the New Testament running order, was actually written first. It is the earliest account amongst the four of Jesus. So what does Mark's Gospel tell us about Judas? It tells us virtually nothing. It says, there are only three references in Mark's Gospel to Judas. So there's the first one saying he was a betrayer. There is then the account of Jesus going, being in Bethany and going to dinner with Simon the leper. And a woman coming and using expensive ointment on Jesus, which caused scandal, they say, amongst the disciples. No one in particular named, just the disciples. And then the next paragraph suddenly goes on completely abruptly and says, Judas Iscariot went to see the chief priests and betrayed Jesus. That's it. I'm sorry, I'm slightly paraphrasing here, but I mean, that's effectively what it says. No explanation at all as to why he would do it. So Matthew, which comes about 10 years later, we think, after writing after Mark, although using similar sources, the missing Q source in that sense. Matthew in lots is a much fuller version. There are all sorts of ways in which Matthew is different from Mark, but one of the ways is that it is fuller on some of those things. And so when he gets onto this betrayal thing, he obviously thinks, you know, Mark didn't really explain it. What is it about? So the way Matthew tells it, Judas approaches the chief priests and asks for money. So he gives him a motivation. Why did he do it? Because he wanted money. Now, going back to our exchange rate, it isn't really much money he's asking for, but he does it for money. It's greed, which, of course, is one of the seven deadly sins. So he actually comes up with some sort of motivation then. Skip forward 10 or 15 years to the writing of Luke's Gospel, and Luke tells us something completely different. No mention of money there. When he talks about the betrayal, he says that Judas betrays Jesus because the devil has inhabited him, i.e. he's doing the devil's work. No mention of money, so completely different set of motivations. But actually, if you think about it, and this goes back to my biography, or indeed my autobiography, of the devil, that idea that you can be taken over by the devil is in some ways kind of slightly it can become an excuse for your behaviour. So if the devil makes you do something, it's not that you intrinsically would want to do. You could still be a good person who is somehow taken over in that sense. So fast forward a bit, you know, another 20 or so years to the writing of John's Gospel, and John doesn't want any doubt left that Judas was a bad person, was the wickedest of all people. So John mixes the two lines. So we've got the idea that we've got Mark telling us no motivation at all. We've got Matthew telling us he was greedy. We've got Luke telling us it was because he was possessed by the devil. John tells us that he was both possessed by the devil and that he was a bad person. So you get all those details only in John that you get nowhere else, that Judas was the keeper of the common purse of the apostles, that he stole money out of that bag, that he was a thief, that he was untrustworthy in that way, in that rather kind of unpleasant but small way, that was part of Judas's character, i.e. that he was rotten to the core, and that he was then possessed by the devil. And of course, there is that extraordinary passage in John's Gospel of the Last Supper, where they, as in the other Gospels, they're saying to Jesus, "Who's going to betray you? Not I, Lord, not I, Lord," and all of that stuff. But in Jesus's Gospel, again, sorry, slightly paraphrasing, but he takes the sop of bread and says, "The one that I'm going to give it to is the one who's going to betray me," and he passes it to John. One of the things that I do in the book is I try and see how these ideas were lived out later on. And I go to a place called Volterra in Italy in the 12th century, which has a very famous pulpit in Volterra. It's a 12th century cathedral, incredibly beautiful, up in the hills of Tuscany. I don't know if anyone's been to that. Perhaps the same person who went to the Free Trade Halls, but no, not Volterra, okay. So you go there, and very, very important to remember in the 12th century that most people got their Christianity, their belief, not through reading, because most of them couldn't read, but through both words and images. So words from the pulpit and images. So imagine the combination of Volterra Cathedral. There is the priest standing over the pulpit, very, very high up this pulpit. And there's a window above it that puts a shaft of light down on the pulpit. And then round on the front is this extraordinary stone carving of that scene from John's Gospel. And basically you have Jesus and 11 of the apostles sitting at the Last Supper table, all looking very perfect, all looking very chiselled and good faces, strong chins. So my mother always told me strong chins were a sign of a good person. So good chins, as I haven't got one, so I'm not going to turn sideways. So good chins as they're standing there. And then underneath the cloth, rather like you'd have a kind of dog under the table, is this peculiar sort of monster-like creature, sort of shriveled monster-like creature, almost snapping at Jesus's heels. And Jesus is taking that sop of bread, now this obviously wasn't a detail in the gospel, but taking the sop of bread and feeding it under the table like you would feed your dog under the table. And while Judas is chomping forward on that, behind him is a snake-like devil figure snapping at his heels. Very, very, very powerful visual thing as you're standing, as I say, in front of the pulpit and the priest is there. So the power of Judas was used in that in those circumstances in medieval times to say, here again, here's this man who is closer to Jesus than you'll ever be, and this is what he did. So if you don't do what we tell you is the right thing to do from the pulpit in that controlling way the Catholic Church had at that time, this is what will happen. The devil will snap at your heels too. So very, very powerfully used in that imagery in the medieval period by the Church. So that's the detail from John on the Last Supper. Of course, interesting to note, in all four Gospels, Judas goes to the Last Supper. So I don't know how many of you are Catholic, but I am. And so what does my church do? Who does it exclude from communion? It excludes remarried and divorced people. It excludes gay people. It excludes people who've been in gay partnerships. It excludes. It's big on excluding the Catholic Church, excluding you from the sacraments. What does Jesus do in the Last Supper? He includes in the Last Supper the person who he knows is going to betray him. Really, 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 really important message for all of us about excluding people. Make me popular with the Pope. Actually, the Pope would probably agree with me, I suspect. But anyway, there we go. I'll never be Pope. So the Last Supper, he is there. It's a really powerful thing. The one person who slightly has a problem with that is Luke. So in Luke's Gospel, he moves around the revelation and the sort of giving of the bread and wine. So the bread and wine is given before the revelation of Judas is there, because he obviously feels uncomfortable with it. Okay, the other detail that we all know from the Gospels is the Judas kiss. Again, extraordinarily powerful cultural idea over 2,000 years. So 2012, for instance, just to pick a year at random, there were three separate thrillers published by different authors, all called The Judas Kiss. The Judas Kiss resonates through history. Why does it resonate through history? The idea of, the most intimate gesture you can give someone also being a gesture of betrayal. It's an incredibly powerful idea. And the Judas Kiss is sort of there in all four Gospels. In Luke's Gospel, Luke, again, is a bit squeamish about all of these things. So he has, the Garden of Gethsemane. So I feel at Greenbelt, I don't need to explain the context to this. But Garden of Gethsemane, identifying Judas identifying Jesus. Luke has Judas try to kiss Jesus, and that sort of purse his lips, so like an air kiss, and Jesus move away. So Judas's lips aren't even fit to touch Jesus's cheek. So that was Luke's idea. But in John's Gospel, interestingly, there is no Judas kiss. Judas is there, sort of lips pursed, as it were. But when the soldiers come in to arrest Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus immediately steps forward and says, "Is it me you're looking for?" So the Judas kiss becomes completely irrelevant. Judas just stands in the crowd at the background. And actually, that's interesting, isn't it? Because if you think about the Judas kiss, one of these details, as I say, that resonates through history, is it really necessary? Think about it. Jesus has spent the whole of the week before in Jerusalem, heralded by people when he arrives on a donkey, the great conquering hero. He's then walked around the centre of Jerusalem preaching something that sort of overturns conventional morality, a really radical preacher. He's turned over the moneylenders' tables in the temple. Basically, he's made a bit of a stir. Jerusalem at the time was a city of 10,000 people. Sorry. Did that wrong again. A city of 10,000 people. It is beyond belief that they wouldn't have known which one Jesus was. Remember the other detail the Gospels tell us. The other 11 apostles, not Judas, were Galilean fishermen. They keep getting it wrong. So, sorry, just to use a bit of artistic license, the best way to think about the other apostles is they're wearing stripy T-shirts and holding a net in their hand. So the Roman soldiers come, there's one really articulate man there, and there's 11 people in stripy T-shirts holding a net. Do you really need Judas to go and kiss him to say where he is? It's not necessary. Part of the book, I go to the Garden of Gethsemane, I sit in the Garden of Gethsemane, you look up at the Temple Mount. I mean, frankly, you can see it from there. Judas could have stood on the wall and said, look, he's that one there. It's not necessary, that detail, but it's there in the Gospels. Why is it there in the Gospels? It's one of those fascinating details, really. There was a line that Graham Greene used late in his life when Graham Greene was a sort of, used to describe himself as an agnostic Catholic, which was an interesting concept. And someone said to him, but why do you keep going back to the Gospels? Why can't you sort of let go of Catholicism if that's what you want to do? And he said, it's the details in the Gospels. It's some of those details that don't need to be there. Why are they there? When they were written down, you know, it gets back to that argument about the authenticity or the truthfulness of the Gospels. The one Graham Greene uses is in that same scene in the Garden of Gethsemane. I think it's only in John's Gospel. They say when the soldiers arrested him, one of the disciples was naked and ran away. You know, why did he need to be naked? What's that about? It doesn't tell you anything. So it's those sort of details that are there in the Gospels. They're always the ones that intrigue me. Again, going back to that thing of listening to the details and thinking, what's that about? So there's that detail about Judas. And I suppose the final detail of those 22 that I ought to mention is Judas's death. He tries in Matthew's, only in Matthew's Gospel, this is interspersed in the whole Passion narrative between Jesus being before the Jewish high priest and before he goes on to Herod. He tries to take back the 30 pieces of silver. He tries to return them to the temple, to the chief priests, and they won't take them. And he then throws the money in through the grill of the temple. I don't know how many of you have got children, but certainly what I've always taught my children is when they've done something wrong, they must go and apologise, and they must try and make reparation. So if they've taken another child's toy, they take the toy back and give it back. Judas, by any conventional means there, was trying to atone for what he'd done, and it was the chief priests who rejected him. And if you remember the story, he then goes and hangs himself. It's in the Acts of the Apostles that he uses the 30 pieces of silver to buy what is called the Potter's Field, which today we call Hakeldama, which is where there's a monastery still, and again the book opens in Hakeldama. So he tries that. Interestingly, if you look through virtually every depiction in medieval Christianity of Judas's story, which was used, as I was just telling you, in the Volterra example, they all include the betrayal, the taking the 30 pieces of silver. They all include the Judas kiss. Plenty of them include the Last Supper and Judas's part of the Last Supper. And lots of them are very keen on the hanging. Lots of hanging going on there, where he looks very devilish in the hanging. Scarcely, there are about three or four examples where these painters, who were constantly illustrating the Gospels, every little detail in the Gospel is illustrated, you'll find about two or three examples in the whole of Europe of medieval examples of that scene of him returning the coins. That wasn't part of the Judas narrative that the Christian church was interested in then, because it didn't have that same power, because Judas wasn't wholly bad in all of that. So, that's where the Gospels come from. But of course, if we think about the New Testament, the Gospels aren't the earliest part of the New Testament. St. Paul's letters are. St. Paul's letters were written probably about 20 years before even Mark. So let's go back to St. Paul. What does St. Paul say about Judas? Nothing. What St. Paul says in his letter to the Romans is that Jesus was betrayed and then went on in his death and resurrection. And why doesn't he name a betrayer? Well, because for Paul it wasn't important. It was one of those, didn't really, really didn't matter. What's important about Jesus' story is that he dies and rises from the dead. The fact that he was betrayed is neither here nor there. And Paul emphasizes that later on in his letter to the Romans when he talks about Jesus' resurrection, and he says the 12 apostles were there. He doesn't say the 12 apostles were there, and as soon as Jesus rose from the dead, he said, hey, Judas, you're doing well to be here, given all you did. No mention of that. He doesn't say, as the Acts of the Apostles say, because the Acts of the Apostles, at the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles, you basically have a by-election, because Judas is gone, and they come up with this figure, Matthias, who no one knows anything about. He doesn't say the 11 apostles plus, you know, that chap Matthias who got in on the by-election. He says the 12 apostles were there. There's no suggestion in Paul at all that Judas was excluded or that Judas had done anything. So why that change then between Paul writing about 40-45 AD and Mark writing about 70 AD? What changed? Well, we know what changed because it's there in the Acts of the Apostles. It says in the Acts of the Apostles that they had a council in Jerusalem where the two factions in what we might call the Jesus movement or the Jesus legacy movement or whatever you want to call it met, and you had the faction led by James, Jesus's brother, who wanted effectively the Jesus movement to be a sort of a radical reforming sect within Judaism, so working within Judaism, and then you had Peter, Paul, and the other apostles who wanted it to be a church for all, who wanted to spread out beyond Judaism, and we know from the Acts of the Apostles that the latter faction won. So that happens between Paul and Mark. So let's go back to Mark now. So it's Mark who first names. So it's Mark who first names the betrayer as Judas Iscariot. Let's look at the name Judas Iscariot. It's odd in that list. Not only is it at the end, it's the only one that tells us where he came from. All the other ones are Peter, Paul, John. I was going to say Mary there, but that's a pop grand, isn't it? Peter, Paul, and Mary. But it's the only one that tells you where he comes from in the word Iscariot. So what biblical scholars have broken down the word Iscariot, and in Hebrew it means "is" is man of, and Keriot, man of Keriot, Iscariot, man of Keriot, is where it's meant to come from. Keriot was a town just to the south of Jerusalem in those times, quite a big town, influential town. So let's think, who are those 11 apostles? Remember the ones with the stripy t-shirts and the fishing net? They all come from Galilee. Judas, we know, Mark tells us, doesn't come from there. He comes from near Jerusalem. And of course, there is that very important play in the Gospels between Jesus being the outsider, being someone from Galilee, and in Galilee, Christianity was regarded by the Jewish elders as a bit too... Judaism was regarded as a bit too lax, not proper Judaism. So you've got all the outsiders, and Judas is the insider. And it goes a step further. The name Judas. Judas comes from the Hebrew verb to thank or to praise. It was an incredibly common name then. Actually, in Germany nowadays, you're forbidden by law to call your child Judas. But anyway, incredibly common then, back in those times. Judas in Hebrew is what do you call it? You say it as Yehuda. No, sorry, you say it's Yehudi. Sorry. And the word for a Jew was Yehuda. So Yehudi, Yehuda, Judas Iscariot, Judas the Jew, Judas the representative of the Jewish establishment. So in Mark's gospel, you know, I said Mark didn't really give you a reason why he did it. Mark is assuming that his readers will know that by the very name Judas Iscariot, Judas was a representative of the Jewish establishment. So Judas went to the chief priests because they were his type. And you see in those later non-canonical Gospels that come much later, some of them speculate that Caiaphas, the chief priest, Judas was his nephew. So that's why he did it. So that connection is made between Judas and the Jewish establishment. And from that connection, which admittedly is relatively tenuous, you get the whole history of Christian anti-Semitism. It all comes from that, Judas Iscariot, Judas the Jew, the traitor within our midst. Judas was the traitor within Jesus' midst. He was allowed into the Jesus movement and he betrayed them. What do Jews do when you allow them into your Christian communities? And this, of course, all comes from the split in Christianity between the two. What do you get? You get Jews who betray you. They become the fifth column. And that story goes on all the way through the medieval period, the 19th century, the 20th century. So medieval depictions, when they depict Judas in medieval depictions, he nearly always has a hooked nose, because Jews are meant to have hooked noses. If I turn sideways, you can see I've got one, and I'm not Jewish, so it's not true. But the idea is that Jews always have hooked noses. He's always depicted wearing yellow, which was the colour of outsiders, dictated by the Second Lateran Council, dictated by the church, and was always the colour that Jews were forced to wear in Christian communities. And of course, we all know about the yellow star that the Nazis made Jews wear. He's always depicted in that way. So the rolling together of Judas as the personification of the Jews starts in Mark's gospel, is amplified. Saint Jerome, who put together the Vulgate, says, we can no sooner trust a Jew in our community than we could trust Judas. It goes all the way through the liking of them. And actually it goes on. So go on to the 19th century, the Dreyfus Affair, which, if you remember, was about a French captain who allegedly sold secrets to the Germans. Huge scandal. Captain Dreyfus happened to be Jewish. He actually was a secular Jew, never went inside a synagogue. What did the French newspapers call him at the height of the Dreyfus Affair? They called him Judas Dreyfus. The headlines always said Judas Dreyfus. And of course, if you look at the propaganda that Nazis used in the Holocaust, it was the likeness between the Jews and Judas, the betrayer, the traitor, the person who can't be trusted. The fifth columnist was there in all that literature. It's all there. That history of Christian anti-Semitism, all down to that phrase, I think, in Mark's gospel. So that's that part of it. I think what might be useful, am I talking for too long? No, that's good. Was also just to see how that story of Judas moves forward as we go forward. So I've talked about the medieval times. Judas was used to scapegoat the Jews, but he was used in lots of other ways to scapegoat other groups. So in early medieval Italy, in those towns of the north of Italy, which really we saw the birth of capitalism in Europe, they were the first people, merchant bankers, which they always used with a hyphen, because you were merchants who also ran a bank. Any merchant bankers here? No. Okay. Someone was going to put their hand up then. Don't be ashamed. I'm a journalist. It's just even worse in lots of ways. Merchant bankers, they were often... The merchant bankers of early medieval Italy, the first capitalists, were nearly all Catholics. The Borgias, for instance, did that. The Medicis did that. They were Catholics, but they were often scapegoated as Judas figures as well because of Judas and the money. That whole medieval debate about usury and charging interest. Anyone who charged interest, be they Catholic or not, they were often depicted or personified as Judases in our midst. So used in all of that. And then moving forward from that, you get a kind of change in tone in how the Judas story is used to scapegoat people with the Enlightenment period, and particularly as you get near to the French Revolution. So, I mean, already in the 18th century with the Enlightenment, where people had much different views, particularly about Jews. They didn't think that Jews were sort of traitors in their midst. They thought Jews were equal citizens. What you see in Enlightenment writing is a much more sympathetic view of Judas. So one of my favourite examples that I quote in the book is Jonathan Swift, who famously wrote Gulliver's Travels, was actually a Church of England dean, I think. Church of Ireland dean, sorry. So an Anglican. And he wrote a whole poem, a rather famous poem, called Bishop Judas, which is all about how the leaders of the church themselves are Judases because they're betraying the people and betraying the lower clergy. I think Jonathan Swift had a bit of a grudge that he hadn't been promoted. So he called bishops Judases. So that Judas scapegoating, that slur of Judas, is actually used against the hierarchy of the church by its lower orders. So their scapegoating is turned against them. Move on to the French Revolution and what came after that. One of the writers that I came across, and I think he started a whole new riff, as one might call it, on Judas, was Thomas de Quincey, the radical writer of the mid-19th century, romantic, radical. What they loved doing was received ideas on their heads. So it wasn't enough to use Judas against church figures, to scapegoat church figures with Judas. He actually wanted to make Judas into a hero. So what his very famous essay on Judas suggests is that Judas was a kind of political radical figure. So there you have Jesus and Judas in Jerusalem in the first century. And what Judas is hoping, and again, go back to context, historical context with the Gospels is all, what do we know at the time? That the Jews resented Roman overlordship. They didn't want the Romans to be in charge of them. They wanted the Messiah to come and free them from Roman rule. Judas believed that's what Jesus was. So Jesus gets to Jerusalem, and much to everyone else's delight, but to Judas's disappointment, Jesus keeps saying, "Render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. My kingdom is not of this world." And Judas gets rather cross with that. He doesn't think that's what should be happening. So Judas betrays Jesus to the Roman authorities, according to Thomas de Quincey in the 19th century, because he wanted to spark a political revolution. He thought that if Jesus got arrested, that would make the Jews rise up against the Romans in a way that that Judas didn't want it to do. And that idea has been very popular through the 19th and 20th century of Judas as a kind of Che Guevara figure. And I'm sure none of you have seen this, but in Andrew Lloyd Webber's Jesus Christ Superstar, that is is who Judas is. It comes from Thomas de Quincey. So, you know, he is there as the kind of radical. I mean, in many ways, he's the most attractive figure in Jesus Christ Superstar. I always get very confused in Jesus Christ Superstar because at the end of Jesus Christ Superstar, so we see Judas hanging because Andrew Lloyd Webber likes a nice dramatic moment. But at the very end, it's Judas who seems to get resurrected from the dead because he's back on stage there, which I think Lloyd Webber's got his theology a bit wrong there. And I'm not quite sure what this is about, but he manages at the very end, he always does that little reprise of the Mary Magdalene song, I Don't Know How to Love Him, about Jesus. I'm not quite sure what he's suggesting there, but anyway, that is all in there. One of the things that you have to think about looking at the Christian treatment of Judas through those centuries is the whole question of free will. Because there have been two sort of personifications, really, of Judas as you go forward. One is as Satan's agent, as the devil's agent, so the wickedest of the wicked. And then as you move much more towards our own age, there's that idea that Judas may possibly have been doing God's work. That, you know, if Jesus is God's son, and Jesus comes to earth with a purpose, that purpose was known already, that the person who betrays him is a cog in the wheel in that sense. Going back to Bob Dylan wrote a song called With God on Our Side, which some of you may know, and there's a whole verse in there about Jesus. We have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on his side, is in there. He wasn't playing that when they shouted at him. But that's an interesting question for us. I mean, one of the things you have to look at there is the whole question of free will. Was Judas exercising his free will? Now, the medieval Christian church was really, really, really unkeen on that. They wanted Judas all the way through history. They wanted him only to be seen in a bad light. And so what you have in lots of those extra canonical gospels that came, again, right through to the medieval period, is they couldn't think of a bad enough thing to say about Judas. It's as if John hadn't said enough. They had to think about worse things. Two of my favourites, just very quickly. About the 5th or 6th century, we have the Gospel of Nicodemus. Now, one of the things that organisational Christianity has tended to do is to blame women for things, to think that women lead us astray. Starts with Eve, obviously. So what the Gospel of Nicodemus tells us is that... So you have the betrayal. Jesus is taken off and arrested. And Judas then goes home to visit Mrs. Judas, who's waiting at home for him. She's cooking his supper, because that's obviously what women do. They wait at home and cook their husband's supper. And Judas is carrying a rope. And he says, oh, God, Mrs. Judas, I've just betrayed Jesus. And I've got an awful feeling. When he said he was going to be raised from the dead, he was telling the truth. And I've done a terrible thing. And Mrs. Judas says, oh, nonsense. He's as likely to rise from the dead as this chicken is to fly out of the pan. At which stage, in the Gospel of Nicodemus, the chicken flies out of the pan. So, you know, Judas is bad, but Judas is being so bad that actually he does what a woman tells him. What could be worse? Anyway, there we go. But my favourite one of all of them comes in The Golden Legend. I don't know if any of you ever read those stories in The Golden Legend. It's still in print in Penguin Classics. So about the 13th century, Jacob of Verrain, Dominican, Archbishop of Genoa, he collected the sort of stories. And the reason The Golden Legend is so valuable is because it tells us what was preached from medieval pulpits, the sort of story... beyond the gospel stories that people told to get their point across. And so he tells the story of all the apostles, and he gets on to number 12, Matthias, the one we know nothing about, who got in the by-election, and he manages about two sentences. And he says, oh, actually, Matthias is a bit boring. Let's talk about Judas. And what he, in the pages that follow, he gives you what you might call, or Hollywood would call, a prequel to Judas's story. You know, how did he get to be so bad? So they do his whole childhood. So very briefly, I mean, in case you're not going to read The Golden Legend, what happens in this version of Judas's story, and this is again, is Christianity painting Judas as bad as bad can be. Judas, a couple called Simon and Cyberea, and Cyberea is pregnant. Simon, obviously taken because we know in John's Gospel that Judas's father was called Simon of Iscariot. So Simon is the dad. That's the only link to the Gospels. So Cyberea is pregnant. She keeps having nightmares, thinking she's going to give birth to a monster, and she can't quite work out what to do about it. So she decides that when she has the child, she must put it in a basket and push it out to sea. Bit of Old Testament there for you with Moses. So this child is floated out into the sea and bumps into an island called Iscariot. That's where he said Iscariot comes from, called Iscariot, where it just so happened that a childless queen was walking along the beach, as childless queens do, and she saw the basket bump into the shore, and she reaches down, picks up the baby and says, I'm a childless queen, this baby is going to be my baby, he will be my heir, my successor. So Judas is raised as... as the heir to the island of Scariot. And then, by a miracle, because these things happen with childless queens, the childless queen conceives, and she has her own baby, who, of course, will be her rightful heir. So Judas, being the worst of the worst of the worst, what does he do? He kills his stepbrother. And he is in such disgrace that he's sent back to the mainland, to Jerusalem. And being the worst of the worst of the worst, what does he do? He gets a job with Pontius Pilate, as Pontius Pilate's right-hand man. So there, this is all in Jacob of Rain, the golden legend. This is what was preached in medieval churches. So they're standing, looking out of the window of Pilate's office, and Pilate says, "Lovely orchard down there, Judas. I'd love to have that orchard." And rather than go to the local estate agent, Judas goes round to the orchard, finds the owner of the orchard, who is called Simon. And he kills Simon to get his orchard off him. But that wasn't enough to do, because Simon's orchard has passed to his widow, Cyberea. So what does Judas do? He seduces Cyberea in order to get the orchard. And then they both realise what they've done. That he seduced his mother. And he has a complete crisis. He says, "How could I be such a bad person?" And he wanders off, all in the golden legend, this, I'm not making it up. He wanders off, they might have been. He wanders off into Galilee, because that's a sort of wilderness. And when he's in Galilee, what does he do? He bumps into Jesus with 11 men in stripy t-shirts with nets. And he says, "Jesus, I have done the most terrible thing. I have, you know, I've seduced my mother, my son." And Jesus forgives him. Jesus forgives him. And so Judas gets to join. That's how this outsider Judas gets to join the apostles, because Jesus forgives him. And what does he do? Because he's the worst of the worst of the worst of all people. Having been forgiven once by Jesus, he then betrays him again. So he is rotten to the core. So that's what Christianity wanted us to believe about Judas, that he was absolutely rotten to the core. If you, as I say, as you move forward, you get the changing view right up to Andrew Lloyd Webber. And I'm going to finish by just telling you one thing, which I think answers that final question, was Judas really so bad? And I hope I've sort of touched, I think you've sense of what I might think about it up to now. This all takes us to a little church in Dorset, which I don't know if any of you have ever visited, called St. Nicholas in Morton in Dorset. An extraordinary church, ever in Dorset, just south of Dorchester, in a maze of lanes, amazing church. Not a particularly interesting 18th century Anglican church. Next to an airbase during the Second World War, Germans dropped bombs, blew out all the windows, and so it needed 12 new windows. Just along the coast lived an artist called Sir Lawrence Whistler, brother of the more famous Rex Whistler, but pretty famous himself. Very, very famous for doing this thing that he revived this medieval art of glass engravings. It's not like etching, it's engraving. You engrave on the glass. These windows are extraordinary that he did for the church. The light comes in and out. If you think with a stained glass window, it's mostly about the light coming in from outside. This way, it's a two-way process. So he did, over a period of about 20 or 30 years, he did these windows for the church. They're all marvellous. And towards the end of his life, in 1984, there was a 13th window there. And Judas is sometimes called the 13th apostle, even though technically he was the 12th, but that by-election chap Matthias got in, so he's number 13. Of course, 13's a bad number, and nothing bad is bad enough for Judas anyway. So the third. So Whistler said, "Why don't I do a window for you of Judas?" So he started doing a window of Judas. Vicar said, "No, not having him in my church. He's the worst of the. Why would I want him in my word?" Parishioners got together. They said, "No, we don't want Judas. Why would we want to think about Judas in our church? You know, terrible example. Shouldn't be there with the other 12. Referred to the local bishop in Dorchester. He said, "No, you can't have it in the church at all. Don't want it there." But of course, Whistler had done the window. So a bit of an outcry. Some of you might remember it at the time, because he was a very famous artist being turned down with this window. His gift couldn't go there. A compromise was arrived at whereby the window was put in store in the local Dorsetshire Museum. Now, I'm a big fan of women's ordination, and about 30 years later, here's a really good reason for women's ordination, along came a new vicar of St. Nicholas Morton called the Reverend Jackie Birdseye, which I was thrilled at her name, because it means that when I was a child, there was actually a Captain Birdseye. It wasn't made up. Anyway, the Reverend Jackie Birdseye came along, and she is brilliant. And so what she did was she sat all these idiots down, knocked their heads together, and said, "For goodness sake, we've got this priceless window. Why don't we put it in our church?" So she got them to agree. So I went down to see it with my son one afternoon, and a long drive to Dorset. We got there, and we wandered around the church. And so you've got the 12 windows in the church, and they're all wonderful, and all the things that you would know, and it's marvellous. couldn't be better. And I kept saying, but where's Judas? I can't see Judas anywhere. So we end up by doing terrible sacrilegious, I'm very Catholic, terrible sacrilegious things like standing on benches to see if it's down at the bottom of the windows. Still no sign of it. Another good thing about Jackie Birdseye is she's got her mobile phone number in the church porch. So I rang her. An even better thing about Jackie Birdseye, she stays in on a Sunday so she can take calls. So I rang her and said, where is this window? I've come all the way. And she said, it's round at the back. It's in a blind window. That was the compromise. They had to put it in a blind window. You can't see. So it's right round at the back by the graveyard. And we went round, and this is why they wouldn't have it in the church. So what Whistler does, and this is the Judas we need to think about. What Whistler does, it's Judas hanging, as in Matthew's account of him, on Hakeldama. And from the top of it, most important thing about him is he's dressed in everyday clothing. He's wearing Wellington's corduroys and a gardener's jumper. So this is Judas's everyman. Do you ever think, this is certainly what I thought as a child, when you listen to the Gospels and you listen to the 12 apostles, who of course are meant to be like us, are meant to be human and flawed like us, obviously the one that we're meant to think about is St. Peter, because he denied Jesus 3 times and the cock crowed twice. But I've always found St. Peter a bit distant, even though I'm named after him. I've always found him quite hard to get close to. I mean, this is the man who has the keys to the kingdom of heaven. This is the man who was the first pope, supposedly. I mean, that doesn't make him very human and flawed like most of us, does it? I'm not expecting the keys to the kingdom of heaven in that sense. So he's the one who's meant to be like us. I suppose doubting Thomas with the sign. It's always seemed to me that Judas is the most human of the apostles, because he does something very wrong. We've all done something very wrong in our lives. We've all betrayed someone in our life, I think. Or people have perceived us as having betrayed them. And actually, I might even suggest that, you know, some of us have kissed someone in our life and not really meant it at that stage. It's always seemed to me that Judas is a much more human and approachable figure. So what Lawrence Whistler is saying with that clothing on his Judas is Judas is every man. Judas is us. He's kind of fallen humanity in that sense. And what happens from the top of the window is that the lights are coming down from heaven onto Judas's face. There's a beam of light coming down. So this is Judas as God's agent. Judas is the cog within the wheel. This is not Judas as the devil's apostle, the devil's agent in that sense. But the most important detail of all is dropping out of his pockets as he's hanging. You can't see his face is turned away, are the 30 pieces of silver. And as they touch the ground, they spring up as flowers. So this is Judas, reformed, rehabilitated, or the word that we would probably use more here, this is Judas redeemed. This is Judas forgiven. It's really interesting. I'm not so good on Anglican theology, but in the Catholic Church, virtually the only person they insist is still in hell is Judas. Two cardinals had an argument about it recently. And it seems to me that if I... Not that makes it right, obviously. But they have to do something, don't they? So many other more important things to be doing, but they argue about whether Judas is in hell. Anyway, sorry, moving on. It seems to, you know, what do we know about Jesus? Jesus came to forgive our sins. Nothing is unforgivable. So why is this person, why is Judas treated by the churches throughout history as unforgivable, as the one bad person? It seems to me one of the reasons that I am still Catholic, that I am a Christian, is because I believe that through God's grace, all of us, in some way or other, are, whatever faults and bad things that we do in our life, that we are reformable, rehabilitable, and redeemable. And it seems to me that Judas is a pretty potent symbol of that. And if the church would embrace him as a potent symbol, if they would think about him, and the evidence is there in the Gospels for that view of him as well, that if we would embrace that more, the story of Judas isn't just a historical or a social or a cultural interesting thing. It's not just a way of doing biblical scholarship and moving around. It's something that tells us really important things about scapegoating and our own capacity to scapegoat. Couldn't be more important in our society at the moment. Who do we blame all the time? When we can't get a doctor's appointment, we blame immigrants. When we can't get a job, we blame immigrants. We like scapegoating. We have a horrible taste for scapegoating. It teaches us about scapegoating, and it teaches us most importantly about forgiveness. We live in a country that imprisons more people than any other country in Europe, bar Turkey. You know, let's start being a bit more forgiving. What better symbol of that than Judas Iscariot? Thank you for listening. Thank you. Stop. I'll get embarrassed. A question. I've talked for a long time now. Please, someone, make me feel better about myself and ask me a question. That gentleman there. You need the microphone, I think.
Oh, yes, very interesting talk indeed. Best I've heard. Yes, I'm Judas.
Thank you.
I keep rather an open mind on Judas. I think the argument that he was just doing a part of God's work, and he's not necessarily, I don't know, but may not be as necessarily the nasty person as we are meant to believe. But to your comment about the Catholic cardinals and their and their portrayal of Judas as the most wicked man ever. Would you think they just take this thought down through the ages without thinking it theologically or not? In other words, surely it's about, they should really reconsider that. I sometimes think there's part of the, in my opinion, being I'm Catholic myself, the ills of the Catholic Church. They just seem to be stuck in this rut of tradition and don't think through things as they should, like you would find in the Anglican Church, for example. And others.
I can't comment on the Anglican Church. Yeah. Well, it seems very attractive to me. I think what happens is there's such a great reverence for tradition and the way that they've always done things that they often don't think about it. I think if you challenge people to think about it, they would. I don't think Judas has particularly been on the syllabus in lots of ways. So I think that's one of the reasons he's just been used. And I think the real reason they don't want to do it is they're so ashamed of the history of anti-Semitism that all stems revolves around Judas. That wicked, wicked history of anti-Semitism. And I think that's one of the things that stops them. They should think about forgiveness, absolutely. Gentleman at the back.
Thank you. It's a slightly academic question, so don't spend too long on it. But in some academic circles, the name Iscariot has been linked to Iscari, which is to do with knife and is to do with the resistance movement. Can you give us your view on whether that's just nonsense or what's the role of that kind of idea?
Okay. The suggestion is that around the... between about 50 AD and 70 AD, there were a group of Jewish revolutionaries who used knives. They used to go around and knife people in public gatherings. They're a bit like suicide bombers now, in a way. And they were called, because they're not the Latin word, I'm not very good at Latin, but the Latin word for knife or what the sort of knife they used was secare. And so they became known as the secare, these people. And one suggestion is that Judas, it goes back to the political revolutionary argument, that he was one of these people who infiltrated Jesus' group. The big problem with that, I'm afraid, is the secare didn't exist till about 50 AD. So the idea that in 30 AD that Judas was the secare just doesn't work. It doesn't work for the time. But there are lots of theories around Iscariot, and most of them absolutely bogus. And I'm afraid the Hebrew translation of Man of Keriot wins by about 90% of 95%. It's a bit of a walkover, like Jeremy Corbyn. So this gentleman here. Sorry.
Two very unrelated questions. The first one, you mentioned how Luke is the first one who says that Judas was possessed by Satan. Another thing about Luke is that in Acts, in all of the sermons given in Acts, whoever is delivering the sermon specifically says, Jesus whom the Jews killed. And I was wondering if there was room for Luke being the place where a change happens from Judas as a symbol of the Jews, having the guilt for Jesus' death, to the guilt being slightly removed from Judas and formally transferred onto all Jews, in that now it's Judas as possessed and all Jews who are guilty. Second very unrelated question. Have you heard the song Judas by Lady Gaga, which has an excellent message of identifying with Judas, which I love?
Do you want to sing it for us? I'm not going to, you'll be glad to know. Just to take the first point I can say more on, really, which is that obviously Luke is generally taken, the author of Luke is taken to be the author of the Acts of the Apostles. What you have at the beginning of the Acts of the Apostles is Peter rewrites Judas's death scene. So he says, it's almost as if hanging wasn't good enough for him. So Peter says, oh no, he didn't hang himself. What happened was he kept the 30 pieces of silver, he bought the potter's field, and because the devil was so active within him, he got fatter and fatter and fatter. The poison within him was so much. And that Judas dies in the Acts of the Apostles written by the author of Luke, by bursting asunder. It's as if all the evil comes out of him. And again, as you go forward in those non-canonical gospels that come later and in medieval writings, the theory that they had was that the stuff that Judas spills on the ground, it says actually his innards fall on the ground, they were the seeds of evil. And the seeds of evil then spread out from the field of blood, from Hakeldama, and they spread out into Jerusalem and infected the Jewish people. So everywhere the Jewish people were in your midst, they carried the stain, the seed, the whatever, of Judas's evil innards. So I mean, a horrible idea. I mean, revolting. I almost feel ashamed to repeat it, but I mean, that's what they thought. And I think, the sin of Judas is visited on all Jews, really. And of course, which is what the Nazis say in their propaganda as well. That's where it comes from. I'm better on Bob Dylan than Lady Gaga, but I still can't even sing the Bob Dylan one with Judas on our side. How about this man here?
Yeah. Picking up and expanding on what you were saying about the anti-Semitism of the early Christian church, I wonder if that gave an excuse at the time for the atrocities of Nazi Germany, their anti-Semitism against Jews, and also whether that's the reason why the church in those days of Nazi Germany weren't criticizing what was happening at that time.
Well, in fairness to the church in Nazi Germany, some of them did. I mean, obviously Pope Pius XII notably didn't. There were figures in all the churches, in the Lutheran Church, in the Catholic Church, who did criticise the Nazis. And I think it's very, very important to remember that the Nazis, their ideology wasn't particularly a Christian ideology. It was much more pagan. They rolled in all these bits to it. But I think they were prepared to annex anything that was around, really. And that, so Christian anti-Semitism suited their purpose. They picked and choose the bits. I don't want to be too damning of the Christian church at that time. Really interestingly, before he became Nazi minister of communication, Goebbels was a budding playwright, I mean, not a very good one, and he wrote a play about Judas. He wrote a Judas Iscariot play, and in his Judas Iscariot play, it's all about God being forgiving and Judas not being as bad as we thought he was. So, you know, he changed his mind, so he moved away from that.
We haven't, sorry. Peter, can I just say a very big thank you to you on behalf of Greenbelt, Peter Stanford, thank you.
Thank you very much.